We experience in the natural order periods of development, growth, and decline. And these are partly observable in nature. There are some more handouts here if you didn't get one. And the natural cycles of growth and decline and development and preparation are observable as natural cycles, but they form a basis for the liturgical cycles. And so the liturgical year anchors itself upon the natural year. And this yellow handout is all of the days of the liturgy as they're compared with the natural cycle and some of the different liturgical cycles. The natural cycle consists of, first of all, the cycles that are determined by the sun, that is, the day and the night, and those which are determined by the moon, that is, the month. And if the month is divided into cycles of growth and decline, these are divided into four, and this gives us the week. So the week is, in fact, a derivative of the cycle of the moon. The seasons are derivative of the equinoxes and the solstices. And you see on the yellow table at the left-hand column, natural, the winter solstice, the 21st of December, the vernal equinox, the summer solstice, and the autumnal equinox. The day itself, daylight, is divided into four. And in the Roman counting, the prime, terce, sext, and nón are the four principal hours of the day, and that gives us the hours of the divine office also. So then, the sacred times, the times of the liturgy, one wants to think in terms of sacred time in general first, and even in relationship to sacred space. The whole topic of the sacred is something that is discussed by anthropologists and is analyzed by people who are fascinated without being committed to the sacred. One can think about sacred space and see that sacred spaces are relative. That is to say, in a church is a sacred space. The altar is the most sacred place in the church because that's where the Eucharist is celebrated or the Mass is celebrated. And the pews where the people sit are parts of the sacred space because this is where the people participate in the same action. The sides of the choirs are a part of the sacred space. And the windows mark the boundaries of the sacred space, while at the same time articulating sacred topics. I'm particularly impressed by the windows here. I like these the best, but they're all really quite magnificent. The sacred space is entered by a sacred portal. So the doors at the back of the church are the point of entry. And in medieval cathedrals, the people came in by a side door, and the main portal was not opened except on major feast days, particularly Palm Sunday, where the whole procession entered in a very formal and ceremonial way. So there is sacred space, but there's also sacred time. And sacred time has to do with articulating the significance of all of these parts of natural time in a sacred way. So that if one looks at the overall pattern, one looks first of all to the Passover. This is an event of history, and it's an event which generated any number of important temporal significances. The sacred time is often considered under the aspect of the four methods of interpreting the scripture. So the literal, the prophetic, the moral, and the eschatological. The literal is what is articulated, particularly in the Old Testament. The prophetic is how something from the Old Testament is realized in the New. The moral is how it applies to the individual soul. And the eschatological is how it applies to the end of time. And so, the Passover. The literal Passover is the passing over of the avenging angel over the houses of the Israelites who have sacrificed a lamb and marked their doorposts with the blood of the lamb. I mean, when you think about that, and when you know what the Eucharist is and the sacrifice of Christ is, you see all kinds of marvelous interrelationships and marvelous correspondences. The Lamb, Christ the Lamb, is then the prophetic sense of the sacrifice of the Jewish, the sacrifice of the Israelites' lambs, and the blood is the means of saving the Israelites from the avenging angel. And so then the blood of Christ is the means of saving us from our sins. Then the moral, and of course Passover means then passing through the Red Sea also, and moving from captivity to freedom. And the prophetic side of it is that Christ's passing from life to death to resurrection then is a fulfillment of the passage of the Israelites. And the moral is that through participating in the Mass, we pass over into eternal life, and the eschatological is we pass over into heaven. So there are a lot of important things that have to do with various significances of time. But then you look at the specifics of liturgical time, and you see that there are relative values, more and less important liturgical times. The most important liturgical times are Easter and Christmas. And you see then that under the table temporale is first of all the Christmas cycle, and then second of all the Easter cycle. The Christmas cycle is prepared by Advent and then celebrated on December 25th, and then its octave, that is, the eighth day is the circumcision in the old calendar, and then Epiphany, the 12th night, is January 6th, The baptism of Christ is the octave of the Epiphany, and then there is a series of Sundays after Epiphany. And the interesting thing about the Sundays after Epiphany is that they contain Gospels that show epiphanies, that is, manifestations of the Lord, so that you have, first of all, on the Epiphany, the visit of the Magi seeking to adore the Lord, the newborn Lord. But then you have the baptism of Christ. Christ approaches John for baptism. And then you have the wedding at Cana, Christ's first miracle, when he first shows himself as being able to perform a miracle. And then you have the finding of the child in the temple, and you have the reading of the scriptures by Christ in the synagogue. All of these are epiphanies, manifestations of who Christ is, narrated in the liturgy in the season of Epiphany. Then you see that there is a long-scale preparation of Christmas. On March 25th, the Annunciation, 9 months before Christmas. So that's the conception of Jesus. Then there's the cycle of John the Baptist. I failed to include one in September, somewhere around the 24th of September, is in the Eastern Church, the Annunciation of John the Baptist. And that's the story of Zachary doing his office as priest in the temple, is visited by the angel who announces John the Baptist. And then 9 months after that, on June 24th, is the Nativity of John the Baptist. Where did he get in there? There it is, June 24th. There's the Nativity of John the Baptist. And then John the Baptist, in fact, also gets a beheading. It's a curious feast, but it's in the more recent discussions of the feast, naming of the feast, it's called the Passion of John the Baptist. So that's the Christmas cycle. The Easter cycle, and you see the Christmas cycle is centered upon the winter solstice, so that the point in the year at which the length of days is the shortest is the point at which Christ is born. And this is symbolic, because he's light, and this is the beginning of the increase of light. And the birth of John the Baptist is in June 24th, the summer solstice, the point at which light begins to decrease. And John, as most of you realize, John said, he must increase and I must decrease. And this is then the significance, the symbolism of the placement of those days on the calendar. There is a question. Is this really the date of the birth of Jesus, the 25th of December? And scholars disagree about that. Scholars of the history of the liturgy disagree about it. Some say Christmas was just placed there by being an antidote to a Roman feast of the inconquerable Son. And Christ the Son then is replaces the Roman Son. But others say, oh no, there was actually an earlier observance of the birthday of John the Baptist. And the birthday of John the Baptist came at the time of Zachary's service in the temple. And the assumption is this is during the Jewish festival, which is at the end of September. The end of September, the conception of John the Baptist gives us June June 24th for his birth, and the Gospel tells of Mary traveling after the conception of Jesus to visit Elizabeth, and and this gives an approximate placement at the vernal equinox, 25th of March. Whether that's true or not doesn't really matter. It's that it's a narrative of the significance of the history of salvation and the history of the Christmas. The Easter cycle is more complicated in its placement on the calendar. It relates to the vernal equinox. But it relates to the vernal equinox in the same way as the Jewish Passover did. And that is, the Jewish Passover was after the vernal equinox, the first Sunday after the first full moon after the vernal equinox is how we place it on the calendar now. There have been some slight adjustments, and so it doesn't always correspond to the Jewish Passover. But it does correspond to the significance of the Passover. And I recommend Benedict XVI's book on Jesus, the second volume, which tells the story of the Passion. And he gives a very interesting and engrossing discussion of the placement of Holy Thursday, the whole series of feast days leading up to Easter. So you have then, in the third column, the Easter cycle, preparation, three Sundays of preparation for Lent, Septuagesima, Sexagesima, Quinquagesima, 70, 60, 50, a pretty approximate designation of weeks. But nevertheless, this is not unusual with liturgical designations. They're approximate and symbolic, not scientific and overly accurate. So 3 weeks of preparation, then Ash Wednesday, and then the whole season of Lent. Now, in the course of corresponding to the winter solstice, the vernal equinox, and so forth, and then the seasons which relate to those, the church also had preparation days for the change of the seasons. And those were called ember days, a short for quatember, which is the name for the change of seasons. And so there are a week, usually Wednesday, Friday, Saturday, of fasting and special observances to prepare for the change of the season. So you see in the Christmas cycle, Ember Days before the fourth Sunday of Advent. And in Lent, Ember Days, Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday after the second Sunday of Lent, and so forth. After Pentecost, Ember Days, and then in September, Ember Days after Holy Cross. So then the whole series of observance of the Passion, Death, and Resurrection of Christ constitutes Holy Week, and Easter, the Resurrection. After Easter, the octave of Easter, that is the eighth day, is something that is very important to be celebrated in the calendar. And so the eighth day is a repetition of the resurrection, is a commemoration, a special commemoration of the resurrection, so much so that the first octave generates a whole year's worth of octaves, that is, of Sundays. And the fact that that the Jewish Sabbath was then transferred for the Christians to the Sunday is because of the octave of Easter. The resurrection on the Sunday and the octave of Easter then sets up the pattern of repetition of Sundays throughout the course of the year, and that we still observe those as Sundays. Then, after 40 days after Easter, Ascension, we had a priest who once told us that the Ascension took place a day after Easter. This somehow contradicts the scriptures, among other things. And then Pentecost is an interesting feast because that's a Jewish feast. It observes the giving of the law on Mount Sinai. And isn't that an interesting comparison? That the giving of the law is then replaced by the giving of the Spirit. And then Pentecost is taken to be the foundation of the church. And then the octave of Pentecost is Trinity Sunday. Trinity Sunday was begun in the north, in Northern Europe, sort of middle of the Middle Ages, but it was only in the 14th century that it was made universal to the whole Roman Church. And so the calendars of the Lutheran and Episcopal churches always count the Sundays after Trinity because they were already celebrating Trinity. The Roman calendars still kept counting the Sundays after Pentecost because they didn't have Trinity yet, so they counted Sundays after Pentecost. And then you get mixed up by how many Sundays after which one it is. But that is, we don't have to worry about that. And so then, after Trinity, after the octave of Pentecost, the Thursday is Corpus Christi, the commemoration of the body of Christ in the old calendar. And this is then a reflection back to Holy Thursday. Holy Thursday is the commemoration of the establishment of the Eucharist. Corpus Christi is a commemoration of the doctrine of the Eucharist. Corpus Christi has its own octave, and then after that, the day after the octave of Corpus Christi is the Sacred Heart. So the Sacred Heart then is very strongly linked with Corpus Christi. And there's another one that I forgot to include, and that is on July 1st. It is the, who knows? The most precious blood. Yes, that's right. You finally have, in the course of the Easter cycle, the ending of the cycle of towards the end of the cycle of the Sundays after Pentecost, the Feast of Christ the King, which was in fact instituted as a kind of, to be blunt, an antidote to Reformation Sunday. Reformation Sunday was the last Sunday of October. And so the last Sunday of October here is Christ the King for the Catholic calendar in the old rite. And after Vatican Council, they wanted not to be so offensive, and so they moved Christ the King to the last Sunday of the year. But we'll come back to that in a moment. Aside, octaves. An octave is the eighth day of a feast day, but the octave means that you celebrate the feast for 8 days. The earliest octave was the octave of Christmas, but it started with a series of saints' days. St. Stephen, the first martyr, St. John, the preeminent evangelist, the holy innocents, the martyrs after the birth of Christ, and then finally the eighth day, observing the circumcision. But it's interesting to look at the Feast of the Circumcision because it had three different names. It was always the Octave of Christmas, and sometimes in the liturgical books it's simply called the Octave of Christmas. Another, and more prevalently, the circumcision, because the Gospel narrates that on the eighth day the child was taken to the temple for circumcision. But there's another very old designation of the feast, and that is the Solemnity of Mary. And this has been the designation of that feast since the Vatican Council, but it was an old one, as witness the liturgy of the Feast of the Circumcision. The Divine Office uses all the psalms that are proper to Marian Vespers and lauds and so forth. And my own choir has taken up the Vespers of the Solemnity of Mary, using the traditional Vespers for the circumcision, which are all Marian texts. O Admirabile Commercium, for instance, the first antiphon of the Vespers. That's right, yes, yes. That's interesting. I hadn't known that. Yeah, thank you. So octaves. In the extraordinary form, there are a number of octaves. Some saints' days get octaves. The octave of the Immaculate Conception, of the Assumption, and that brings us then to the Sanctorale. The commemoration of the saints is also a very elaborate part of the calendar. First of all, apostles and evangelists. The interesting thing is that in a certain tradition, the evangelists were identified with the zodiac. And so each one has his feast placed on the principal day of the month. The principal day of the month by the Roman calendar is not the first day of the month, but the eighth day before. That is to say, the 25th or so. December 25th, then, is the first day of the next month, and March 25th. And then you see the apostles. John on the 27th of December, conversion of St. Paul on the 25th of January, 24th of Matthias, 25th of April, Mark, and so forth. And so then I have a question for you. How many apostles were there? Keep going. 15. So the 12 that Christ called, plus, first of all, Paul, but then when Judas defected, Matthias was elected, and then Barnabas is named in the Acts of the Apostles as a helper of St. Paul. So you have, in fact, 15 apostles on the calendar. So some of them double up, Philip and James, Simon and Jude, and so forth. Peter and Paul is a little different because Paul gets the conversion of St. Paul on January 25th. And the feast day on the 29th of June, Peter and Paul, the texts are largely about Peter. So That's all of the apostles handled there. There is one other omission, and that is the 30th of June in the old calendar is, who knows? The commemoration of St. Paul. So because St. Peter got all the texts on the 29th, there's a commemoration of St. Paul the next day. But then there's the cycle of Marian feasts. Sometimes people don't realize this, but you have the Nativity of Mary on the 8th of September, and then the Immaculate Conception 9 months before on December 8th. And then you have her presentation in the temple. The 21st of November. But then other feast days. The octave of the Nativity of Mary is the Seven Sorrows, for instance, because it follows by just one day the Feast of the Holy Cross. And so forth. You see a number of feasts. An interesting one is the Visitation. The Visitation had to have actually taken place before June 24th because that was the Nativity of John the Baptist. And yet it's here on the calendar on the 2nd of July. Why is that? Because in figuring out where to put it, all the days were taken up until after John the Baptist. And so they put it on the 2nd of July, and the new calendar has changed that back. Finally, feast days of saints. And I've just given you as examples several saints' days, familiar saints that have, for instance, some interesting ramifications. For instance, January 21st is the feast of St. Agnes, and she was important enough that she had a second feast a week later, which is one of the earliest uses of an octave. And then I put in as two examples that relate to me. One is St. Francis of Rome on March 9th, because that's my birthday. And so I always think of St. Francis of Rome at my birthday. And then I put in on June 25th, William of Vercelli. And you can guess why I put him there. That's my name day. And I'm just suggesting that you can, in fact, find your name day and the saint of your birthday as saints that you have a special affection for. So then lots of other saints' days there. Now, the point of the white page is what was done in the Reform. And the Reform had several things which I would say have some pluses and some minuses. For instance, it reduced the octaves to just two, Christmas and Easter. And there's the sad story of Pope Paul, who on the Monday of Pentecost came to the sacristy to celebrate Mass, and out was green vestments. And he said, "No, this is the octave of Pentecost." And they said, "Holy Father, you got rid of the octave of Pentecost." And he was devastated. It's very sad. But you see, those were valuable things, and sometimes the Reform was a little bit too stringent. Other things. They got rid of the season of Septuagesima, the three preparations for Lent. That was also a time of special reflection, and I suppose even served as an antidote to Mardi Gras. two of the Marian feasts were changed to Feasts of the Lord, annunciation, and purification. These are feasts that certainly pertain to the Lord, and so they were changed. But on the other hand, as I mentioned, the circumcision was now changed to the solemnity of Mary. But also there are new saints. The other thing is, one of the principles of the reform was to clear out the calendar during the seasons of Lent and Advent. And so Thomas Aquinas, who was on March 7th, as a possible birthday, death date of him, was moved into January 27th for reasons that I haven't ever figured out. For instance, the Feast of St. Anne has now been changed on July 26th, has now been changed to the Feast of Joachim and Anne. Joachim had his feast day on August 16th, the day after the Assumption, as the father of Mary. The point of the reform was to give greater emphasis to marriage. And so Joachim and Anne was a type of grace. But now Joachim and Anne are types of married love. And so forth. Padre Pio, for instance, a new feast. The Feast of St. Michael was changed into the Feast of the Three, Michael, Gabriel, and Raphael, and so forth. So that's what happened at the Reform. The nice thing to think about is how much is left. Most of it. The Sundays after Pentecost have been turned into Sundays in ordinary time, and who likes the idea of ordinary time as a designation of sacred time? This is a contradiction. But that's only the English translation. It's tempore. Tempus ordinatus, ordered time, is the Latin for that. So even there, it's just a fault among many of the English translations. You have still Christmas and Easter, and you have still the whole series of Sundays and most of the saints' days. The apostles' days have been disrupted somewhat for the reason of clearing out Advent and Lent. And I suppose not all of us observe all 12 or all 15 apostles' days anyway. But that's a little bit of a loss, I would say. But I think it's valuable to think of rather the large-scale significance of the calendar. And that is, Easter is the principal day, and then Christmas is the next important day, and each of those has its own cycle of beginnings, maturity, and conclusion, and then the whole cycle of saints' days surrounds that like a crown over the principal days of the year. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, it's almost time to eat lunch.
Is there some significance to the Feast of St. Joseph being placed on March 19th? And it's always during Lent. Right?
Yes. Yes, and it has been retained there. It was too important a feast for them to mess with. They didn't dare mess with feasts that were really important. And I don't know why St. Joseph is placed there. That raises a good question. Why are saints' days placed where they are? There's a point I forgot to mention. But generally speaking, it's the death date of the saint, their heavenly birthday. Because saints are born in original sin, so their birth date is not commemorated It's their heavenly birthday, except there are three nativities. Who have nativity feasts? John the Baptist, Mary, Jesus. Jesus, obviously. Mary, because of Immaculate Conception. And this is an interesting point that isn't very often brought up. But the Feast of the Nativity of Mary is very old, much older than the Feast of the Immaculate Conception. But the Feast of the Nativity of Mary says she was born in grace, not in original sin. And then John the Baptist, because at the Annunciation, the child leapt in the womb of Elizabeth as a recognition of Jesus, and the teaching has always been that he was cleansed of original sin at that point, and so he has a nativity. But those are the only three that have nativities, as far as I've ever been able to see. And yet, the death date of most saints, but other reasons for the establishment of a feast day is particularly the day of the dedication of a church in honor of a saint, so that on the calendar there are dedication days. There's the dedication day. The principal one is the dedication day of St. John Lateran on November 9th, because that's the principal cathedral. That's the Pope's cathedral. St. Peter's is not the Pope's cathedral. St. John Lateran is, and so that dedication day stands out. But dedication days, for instance, of a church of St. Michael gives us September 29th for the Feast of St. Michael, etc. And dedication days of any church can be celebrated as important festivals, as can the patronal feast day of a church. My parish is the parish of St. Thomas Aquinas, and his feast is coming up. His new feast, January 28th, is coming up, and so we'll have special celebrations for that feast day. Lots of other reasons for the designation of a saint's day. That's a good question. Let's see. So that was that. The nativity was the other one that I wanted to make sure to mention. Yes. Other questions? Yes.
In the
East, that's already found in the 5th century. I recommend a couple of pieces of literature. Butler's Lives of the Saints was updated, I suppose, in about the 1950s and published in four volumes by the Newman Publishing in Baltimore, I think. A nice big set of four. That's where I've gotten lots of my information about the establishment of feast days. You look up the saints, and at the end of the article about the saint, it tells when his feast day was established. Another one is recent, the Oxford Companion to the Calendar. And that is by a musicologist, Bonnie Blackburn, and a classicist, who has a funny name and I've forgotten it now. Neither one of them are Catholic, but they summarize a lot of important information about the calendar. Details. They don't have so much of the overall view of sacred time, but they do have information about the data of the calendar. Partly because Bonnie Blackburn is a Renaissance musicologist, and these topics about the role of the saints in the liturgy are important in Renaissance musicology. Yes.
Do you have any literature choices for the actual time in the church, and then also for the switch from Vatican Council?
I think the Oxford Companion will actually give you the information about that.
It will.
Yeah, there must be something a little bit more pertinent to the Catholic situation, but I don't recall anything offhand. Does anybody think of anything? If you look on the internet, you're sure to find a lot of sites that complain about it. And, you know, you have to take two views on it. One is, there was something destructive about that reform.
Yeah.
The other is, it's what we have. And it kept a lot that was good. And so, barring any other changes, it's what we are obliged to observe. There are times when one can revert to older practices, which the liturgy sometimes permits. For instance, the use of incense. They don't really prescribe that so much, but we use it every Sunday at the introit and at the elevation, as well as at the gospel. And at the offertory. So many things can be kept. You can keep the gradual instead of the responsorial psalm. And that raises then another question that I wanted to just give a comment on, and that was something that already Horst addressed a little bit yesterday. What can we do about the fact that we've lost a lot of Gregorian chant? The first answer is, come to something like this. The second is, take it home. Gregorian chant still has officially the status of principal place in the liturgy. It is still the normative liturgical music of the Roman Rite. There's an article coming out in the new Sacred Music, which is discouraging because Musicam Sacram, the first document on the use of music after the Council, established a principle that was not included in the Constitution on the Sacred Liturgy, but said, okay, Gregorian chant is principal music for the Latin liturgy. But as soon as you have the vernacular, then you have no obligation. That's a serious mistake. And you can see now, after 50 years, we're beginning to recover some Gregorian chant in English. The new translation of the Roman Missal for English includes in the right place, melodies for the priest, not in an appendix, but in the actual body of the ordinary of the Mass. And now we're getting, as Horst mentioned, particularly Father Weber's Mass propers using Gregorian chant. The difficulty is you have to persuade people of it. And the person that you first of all have to persuade is, guess who?
The pastor.
But you see, you are the specialist. And if you arm yourself with a good knowledge of the documents, read the Constitution on the Sacred Liturgy, read Musicam Sacrum, and everything since. Don't read Sing to the Lord too obediently, because it was never really confirmed. I could tell you more about that, yet I don't need to. Arm yourself with the documents. I once was told it's forbidden to sing the Dies Irae by my pastor. And I said, oh, for my own education, could you give me a citation of the prohibition? He said, you know I can't do that. So that settled the issue. Every pastor is going to be different, and you have to offer him your expertise and the options about what can be done. Okay, maybe just adding one or another chant proper. At communion time, there's often time to do a chant proper as well as whatever else is traditional. So you don't, and I would say even a chant proper in Latin, because just a little bit of Latin in the liturgy can set a sense of the sacred that is otherwise not there. I have to say also, I think there's another cause of people's allergy to Latin. It's not to the language. It's partly to the music, but it's mainly to the transcendence which that music represents. That the music that we have in the parish is indistinguishable from the music of the secular society. And so many people in the church today are members of the secular society who have adopted all its values. You impose then a music that represents a transcendence from these values, that represents something eternal instead of something secular. And it scares people. They don't want that. They're comfortable with the secular. And so they have to be educated. You see, your job is not to fight them, it's to educate them. And the way of educating them is introducing things gradually and slowly and watching how they're received. You have to watch out that in any parish there may be a very small clique of people who have organized an objection to what you're doing. That has to be dealt with the pastor. And sometimes the pastor caves in on people like that, even if it's a small group. I have survived, I think, 8 pastors. Go thou and do likewise.